listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today's Monday, November 15th, 2010. And today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with Vermont mathematician, professor, and author Joseph Mazur. Joseph Mazur is professor emeritus of mathematics at Marlborough College, where he has taught a wide range of classes in all areas of mathematics, its history, and philosophy. He holds a PhD in mathematics from MIT and is a Guggenheim Fellow. He is the author of The Motion Paradox, the 2005-year-old puzzle behind all the mysteries of time and space, Euclid in the Rainforest, Discovering Universal Truth in Mathematics, which was a finalist for the 2005 Penn Martha Albrand Award and chosen as one of Choice's 2005 Outstanding Academic Titles of the Year, and the editor of the recently republished classic by Tobias Danzig, Number, The Language of Science. Going to pause for this emergency vehicle. There we go. Joe Mazur's latest book, which we discussed in our interview, is What's Luck Got to Do with It? A book on the history, mathematics, and psychology of gambling, published by Princeton University Press. I began our interview by asking Joe if there's anything that if there's truly a thing called chance.
The question would relate to, is there such a thing as luck, and also is there such a thing as randomness? Mm-hmm. The two really go together. Sure, there is a thing called chance, but we would call chance, but what I would consider is the chance is something that can happen in the future, and luck is a question of what happened in the past. In other words, a person can be lucky, or somebody can be lucky, because he has a history, he or she has a history of luck.
Okay.
So that's something you understand as a past tense kind of thing. When you try to promote it as an object itself, that is, to have luck, to possess it, you're suggesting that there is some future prediction.
Right.
You're actually trying to predict that the person is going to have some something known to him or her that's going to happen in the future. So chance and luck and randomness are three things that really, they're ingredients that somewhat go together.
Right.
But it's really a question of how you are going to express it, either mathematically, psychologically, or historically. And that's why I wrote the book in those three, actually those three sections, because I think in order to understand what I'm trying to get at when I talk about luck, you have to understand the history and the mathematics and the psychology.
Right. Well, before we talk more deeply about the structure of the book, let's just talk a little bit about what's luck got to do with it. How might you describe the book to someone who hasn't yet read it?
That's a good question. You know, I've had quite a number of radio interviews, and nobody's ever asked that question. How would I describe the book? Well, I write books because there's always something that disturbs me, and my knowledge of things. I try to write a book that would be readable to somebody who is inquisitive about things and somebody who really would like to know something that I know, but probably didn't know before I wrote the book.
Okay.
So this book is a book about what I would call a book about luck and what it is. In other words, it's a book about what luck really is. But it's a tough question.
Yeah.
And to know it, it really does take a book. I know what it is not. It's not a thing. It's not an object. It's not something you know, when you talk about in luck, out of luck, luck is on your side. It's not a thing to possess.
And there's no predictability to it.
Right. There is a predictability for the larger scheme. For example, the casinos have a predictability, so they know what luck is, and they know the casinos know what their profits are going to be in the future because they have the mathematics to compute what
okay.
happened. Individual can't really assess what their future is going to be. And one of the problems here is that the individual usually misunderstands the tools that connect to destiny. And the casinos have a destiny, although I can say right now that many casinos in America are not doing too well because of the economy and also because of online gambling taking
right.
over a business. Yeah. But the individual doesn't have that kind of resource because they don't have the volume of money that can be poured into using the mathematics to their advantage.
And what inspired you to write the book?
Many reasons. I've always wanted to write this book because I'll tell you a little bit about my family. My family history is that I come from a long line of gamblers. My father, my grandfather, my uncles, I remember distinctly having bookies come to the house and to my grandparents' house, and I would go with some of my uncles to bookie joints where, you know, I didn't know whether my uncle's knuckles were going to be broken or not. And I come from a gambling background. And I also remember being in a 7-Eleven about 3-4 years ago on a cold winter night when it was Friday night, and it was very late at night, and people were coming in slapping down $100 bills on a lottery that they had no chance of winning. And now is the time to sermonize about the disadvantages of the lottery. But when I left, I realized that I really can't sermonize, but I should write the book. So those are two of the main reasons. A third reason was that I've always been interested in a mathematical phenomenon called the law of large numbers. The law of large numbers has always been misunderstood by many, many gamblers and people, and I never understood it either. I'm a mathematician. But I thought it's such a phenomenal idea, and yet it is a theorem. It is a mathematical law, and that mathematical law tells me something that is very hard to believe. It's a mathematical law trying to predict the future.
Okay.
Now it does it. It does it very beautifully, but it only does it for casinos. It doesn't individual.
Because you need large numbers.
Need large numbers, exactly. It is called the law of large numbers, and sometimes that law is confused with what people normally call the law of averages.
Right.
Which, in colloquial speak, is that, the more often you try something, the more often things are going to average out.
If people did understand it, how do you think this law should impact the average gambler?
Well, If people understood the law, they may have a more rational idea of how to entertain themselves in gambling.
Okay. Now,
gambling is an entertainment business too, and some people feel that that it's a pleasure to be gained by going to a casino or gambling even online. There may be entertainment value, but one has to be very careful about understanding the reasons for why they gamble, and people have to be careful because you can get sucked into habits that are uncontrolled, and some people are more prone to those uncontrolled habits than others, and psychologists know the reasons for these. Some of them are outlined in my book. Now, I feel that my contribution to this game is that if I can explain the law of large numbers, then perhaps some people in their more rational moods would side with a more rational approach to gambling.
Mm-hmm.
The tendency is that when you get into the situations of gambling, that is, you get into the casinos with all the colored lights and the noise and the clinking of coins and whatever else happens in casinos, you lose that rational side of you. Even mathematicians can do that, and just the most rational people can lose their rationality when they get into those situations. There's a pull toward believing in luck, in believing in personal luck.
Yeah, right. Because there's the logical side of our understanding, and then there's the emotional side, and that's what's really sort of pulling us away from logic.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, there's the Pavlovian side. If you can create an environment that suggests luck, that other people are winning things, for example, you hear the coins coming out of a slot machine, then you think, well, you know, there is an opportunity to get more coins out of any slot machine.
Sure.
You're sort of really caught in this bind where you feel, well, you know, I know that it's irrational, but let me put in one more coin or one more dollar, whatever it is.
Right.
So there's that irrational side of all of us. And part of it is, let me describe it in a slightly different way. I like chocolate.
Okay.
And as most people do. And many people have this addiction to chocolate, as I once did. I don't anymore, but there's an addiction. You think, well, the rational side of me would say, I will take a bite of this piece of chocolate. It's wonderful. It's just you know, melts in my mouth, and I just have a very good feeling. Well, what happens, what we now know is what happens in the brain through PET scans. We see that there are areas of the brain that I would say light up. I would use that expression, light up, when we get pleasure from something like chocolate.
Mm-hmm.
Chocolate's a good example. You get pleasure from chocolate, it lights up. But that same area of the brain, of the ventral tegmental area, is also responsible for not only pleasure, but the history of pleasure. So it says, I remember getting pleasure from that chocolate, and I want more of that pleasure. I mean, pleasure is a nice thing. And we're beginning to understand what is happening in the brain when we get to the addiction cycles of things. So, for example, that same area is responsible for addictions in alcoholics, in alcohol, and everything else. So there's no real it's hard to separate alcoholism from troubled gambling behavior. All of these things go together, and they all seem to be the same area of the brain.
Right.
The problem is that one doesn't want to create a science where you're suggesting that the brain, because you see things light up in the brain, that is the cause, or that is telling us something about what is happening in the brain. So, for example, this has been extended to the whole question of thinking. You know, because you show somebody a picture and some area of the brain lights up, that suggests that something is happening in that area of the brain and you're picturing thought. That's not really true.
Okay.
It's only because we're beginning to see some area of the brain light up because perhaps blood is flowing to that area of the brain. But many other things might be masked by, you know, your technology, and you're not seeing those things that are happening. So, you know, I'm one of these people who doesn't believe in the color in the brain.
Yeah.
In PET scans, that's a different thing. We do begin to see that we can't talk about thought in the brain, but we can talk about addictions, because we do know the pleasure sensors in the brain.
Now, the history of that pleasure that perhaps that part of the brain is remembering, if we can, you know, personify that part of the brain, does that fade over time if you quit gambling, for example?
I think it depends on personality. You know, there are controls in the brain. I'm not a neuroscientist.
No.
But I do know from interviews with neuroscientists and a lot of research on it, that there are, everybody's different. And people are prone to have certain kinds of responses to events, and others may not be. In other words, it's a kind of, we're all different, and we have controls and governors in the brain that tend to be different. In other words, there are uncontrolled response mechanisms that allow certain people to go back to their old addictions, and others have. The brain is electrochemical, and there's a whole question of how much of the chemistry of the brain, which comes from all sorts of things. I mean, from biological or genetics and biological history, and all sorts of things that could suggest that you are who you are.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, every other person is going to have a different response to what the control mechanisms are in the brain. So some people will have less control over their desires, and others more.
All right. I'm actually thinking this might be a good time for you to read from the book, Joe.
That's great. Okay. The introduction. So here it is. When I was a child, my uncles would gather every Saturday at my grandparents' house to sit at a long dining room table telling jokes while accounting their week's gambling wins and losses. My grandfather, Morris, would retire to a musty back room, crank up his red-brown mahogany Victrola, lie diagonally across a double bed with his eyes closed and his feet off to one side, and listen to the distant voice of the velvety soprano Amalita Gallicozzi sing Gilda's arias from Rigoletto. Gambling was the family pastime. During those moments when my grandfather was half asleep on the bed next door, my uncles were eager to hook me onto horse racing. My Uncle Sam would give me a quarter and betting instructions. "You gotta analyze," he said one day. "You gotta know the value of the odds, but the first and most important thing is to be sure that your horse has a good chance of coming in on your bet. If you don't like a horse 'cause of its name or 'cause you don't feel lucky that day, don't bet on it, and don't bet on a horse that's overly backed. Here, look at Victory Dancer. She's a 3-1 favorite. What do you think?" "I don't like the name." "Good. Then it doesn't give you good luck. How about..." And I was a very impressionable young boy and took good luck to be some invisible thing enigmatically passed from one person to another. There were times when I had it, days when I'd wake with it, moments when I could feel it. And then there were times when I sensed it disappointingly gone, like the fudge at the bottom of a sundae. One day, I won a minor door prize at Radio City Music Hall. What luck! I won a tub of Topps bubblegum and was called to the stage to pick it up. Very exciting. That day I had it and felt it with an empowering energy that could have propelled me to the stars. But the next day, my bicycle was stolen from a rack of 20 others, and I spent the day whining, "Why me?" to myself. Had it not been for my Uncle Herman, I would have believed that the Roman goddess Fortuna, turning her wheel, impelled the rise and fall of my own luck. On days when I knew my number was on top, I would risk tossing my glass Aggie shooter in a game of marbles or buy a few packs of bubblegum baseball cards and feverishly unwrap them, hoping to find a Phil Rizzuto or a Mickey Mantle. Herman walked into the room at the moment Sam was giving me gambling instructions. Somehow my Uncle Herman escaped the gambling gene. He was monumentally built, tall, sturdy, and solid, with an imposing power of speech and a voice that was both mellow and thunderous, like the roar of a lion that had swallowed a gallon of honey. Herman warned me of the family gambling addiction. "Watch out for your Uncle Sam and Al. They'll give you 50 cents and you're hooked forever. They'll give you advice on a horse that will win, and from then on, it's in your blood. What will be in my blood? I asked, thinking he meant contamination leading to some foul disease. The nasty Hialeah delusion. What's that? It's the message whispered in a gambler's ear whenever he comes close to a racetrack. What does it whisper? You've got luck on your side, he whispered as if it were some secret meant only for my ears. Belief that you have luck on your side confuses you to think you have supernatural personal control over what happens to you. But you know, there really isn't any such thing as luck to have or not have. Everything that happens because everything in the world just happened. They only gave me a quarter, I said, just to set the record straight. Not completely understanding his little secret, I continued to believe that my own luck gave me absolute control, at least for those days when I had luck, and placed my quarter with Sam to bet on some horse called Bright Star to show. It showed all right. I had no reason for picking one thoroughbred from the next, but there was something in that Bright Star and something in that day at the races that passed the torch of luck to me. Collecting 50 cents, I felt the heat of the torch and was hooked. Herman was angry because he knew that the thrill of that first win was the hook. Now, Herman had a funny laugh that seemed to come from his nose. Not a snort, but rather a nice laugh that was honest and charming. But when he was angry, his powerful voice would rise in volume and deepen in pitch to assure you that he was irked and that you'd better attempt to change his displeasure. Okay, okay, said Sam after Herman boomed out his censure. Your uncle is right. You are lucky this time. But you should remember that in the end, the track wins. You should remember more than that, Herman thundered. Look at your uncles who sit around this radio every Saturday afternoon after they've called their bookies. Do they look rich to you? If they know so much about horses and gambling, why aren't they rich? Don't gamble on a horse that you know nothing about. Even the best horse can slip in the mud and break a leg right in the middle of a race. Even the best horse can be unlucky some days. As soon as Herman left, gambling conversation would resume. And over my teenage years, my uncles would give me lessons on luck and mathematics of gambling odds. Suppose I make a $2 bet on a number that has 100-to-1 odds of coming up. My uncle Carl once asked me, and suppose the winning payoff is $100. How many bets should I make to give me an even chance of winning? Looks to me that you'd have to bet $2 100 times to be sure to win. So it would cost you $200 to win $100. Not a good return. No. That's not what I'm asking. I'm asking how many bets must I make just to have an even chance? Then you must make 50 different bets of $2. I'd be spending $100 to make $100, no? Sure, I said. But there's no guarantee that you'll win after betting on 50 different numbers. You might lose. The only guarantee is if you bet on every number. Yes, yes, that's right. But I'd be losing $100. The whole point of gambling is to beat the odds, not match them. Well, then, I suppose you just have to bet $2 less than 50 times to make and take your chances. Yes, Carl said with a contorted smile. That's called gambling. You have to take your chances to beat the odds. You have to have luck to win. So
that's great. Thank you for reading that section. I was wondering in reading about your uncles if maybe their influence in your life had something to do with your initial interest in mathematics as well.
Well, it's possible. I always thought that my brother's influence was stronger than my uncle's. My uncles did give me instructions in gambling and gambling odds. Not sure that my interest in gambling came from the odds, though, because when I was younger, even as a mathematician studying mathematics, I took a course in statistics and probability, and I hated it. I didn't like that course.
Oh, that's interesting.
I didn't understand it until I had to teach it. And then I realized what it was all about, and I just began to love it. And so,
wow. It's lucky that you went as far as teaching it.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I wouldn't have written this book otherwise, because I part of it was I really enjoyed teaching it and therefore understanding it.
Mm-hmm. Now, I wonder if we could talk about the Monte Carlo fallacy.
Yeah, the Monte Carlo fallacy is it's connected very much with the law of large numbers. That is, because something has come up a certain number of times, let's say you're dealing with roulette, and you have black and red, and black has come up 7 times in a row. Now, one possible fallacy for a certain group of people would be, well, black has come up so many 7 times in a row, that's not random, to think that it's not random, and then say to yourself, well, it's red's turn to come up. Red is due.
Red is overdue, right.
Yeah, red is overdue, and therefore I will bet on red. The other part is another fallacy, which is, wait a second, black is hot. this is what's called the hot hands fallacy. They're both connected, actually, but it's the hot hands fallacy. And you think that black is hot, that is, the wheel is hot. There's something not random about the wheel. And therefore you think, well, I'm going to bet on black because I think black is hot. The problem is that people are misunderstanding what randomness actually is. So take a string of numbers. Let's suppose I ask my audience, let's say. Here I have a mythical audience out there. And I ask this audience, give me a string of 20 numbers, each being 0 and 9. And just try to give me that string, you know, just randomly. But it has to be as random as you possibly can think of random numbers. So people will come up with 0, 3, 5, 9, 6, 2, 3, 8, and then continue that way. Very few people in the mythical audience will say 0, 5, 3, 6, 6, 6, 6, 6, 6, 6, 5, 9, 9,
okay.
9, 9. And because they are conscious of they had used an earlier number too frequently.
Okay.
Now randomness, true randomness means that the number generator doesn't have a history. It doesn't know what it said before. But the human does know what he or she has said before. So there's this misunderstanding of what randomness really is.
Yeah.
That is, and if you really take a random number, you will find long strings of the same number because it just coincidence. It just happened. Coincidences do happen.
Right.
And they happen frequently. In fact, you know, it's I had it in one of my previous books. I think it was in the book. Euclid in the Rainforest, another book. I talked about that. I talked about the frequency of coincidence. There is a professor who is met in a cafe in Greenwich Village, and the student just happens to meet the professor there and his own professor, and he said, "Gee, isn't it amazing that I just met you in this cafe?" And he said, "Well, what if you had been in the cafe across the street? You would have met me, but isn't that a coincidence as much as the coincidence of actually being in this cafe?" In other words, we have so many coincidences that really happen, but we're not aware of them.
Right.
So, I mean, you don't know, for example, you're in your study at this moment, and you don't know who is around the corner from you that you had not seen in 50 years. not you, because years old. But
no, 40 years. Let's say 40 years. Now, I'm curious, are you at all superstitious in any area of your life, Joe?
Yes. Yes.
You are?
Of course, yes.
Now, yeah. Do you tell yourself I'm being silly? This is superstition.
Yes, I do. I do, but it's a kind of like a, I play this game of what I call reverse voodoo. You know, when my children are learning how to drive, for example, and they're out on the road, you know, every parent goes through this, I think. They're thinking, oh my God, where are they at this moment? And I think as long as I can keep them in my mind, I'm keeping them safe. I know that's not true, but, you know, it is this reverse voodoo. As long as I can control, and it is a sense of control.
Yeah. That's so funny because when my son was learning how to drive, I just tried not to think about it at all.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
It's the opposite.
Yeah, well, that helps too.
I wonder if I could just read a tiny section of the book.
Sure.
This is from your chapter 10, The Skill Luck Spectrum. Mm-hmm. And it says, Vermont generates revenue of over $100 million a year on lottery tickets with a profit of about $23 million. Yet the entire population of Vermont is only 624,000, and the number of households is only 241,000.
Yes.
A 2008 survey conducted by the Center for Research and Public Policy concluded that 40.5% of Vermonters, half of whom attended college, played the lottery regularly. And on average, households of Vermont spent $414.93 a year on lotteries. This just blew me away.
Isn't that amazing?
I had no idea that there were that many people playing the lottery.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's...
And how many people have won the... How many Vermonters have won Megabucks? Any?
Well, it depends on what you mean by lottery. I should say, if you take the Megabucks, for example, right. Or the Tri-State... I think it's... Is it the Megabucks or the Tri-State? I can't remember which. But one of those, none. No Vermonter has ever won it.
Okay. I thought maybe I heard you say that in a talk.
It's not amazing, really, because think about it. I mean, people in Boston are playing it. There are more people in Boston than all of Vermont.
Sure.
So why, you know.
Right. Right. Yeah. So we're at a terrible disadvantage as lottery players here in Vermont, aren't we?
No.
No, we're not.
Yeah, everybody's at the same advantage.
You're right. We're all unlucky. That's great. So in reading the third section of the book, Joe, I found it interesting to see all of the possible reasons emotionally that people gamble. Yeah. And it seems that our ego is often at work. Can you talk about that?
Well, it's the whole question of the illusion of control. I suppose that's part of the ego.
Yeah.
The ego doesn't want control. And there is that, the illusion that you can control your destiny. But, you know, it's also a question of faith. And so you have a faith in luck. And there's a whole, you know, the whole question of why we gamble is connected to that illusion of control, but also the history of, you know, what makes us take risks, which is, you know, leaving the cave to go out and hunt. Otherwise, I mean, we wouldn't leave our houses to enjoy ourselves or do whatever we do. Because there is a risk in leaving the house. Or maybe there's not a risk in leaving the house. I don't know. But there's a risk. It certainly was a primordial risk in leaving the cave. You know, the cave is warm, and, you know, why do you go out on a hunt when there's a saber-toothed tiger around the corner?
Now, you mention in the book some very famous people who were terribly addicted gamblers, Dostoevsky and Tolstoy, to name two writers.
Mm-hmm.
And people who lost everything. I mean, so many people have lost everything.
I met people at the casinos who I met one person who lost two houses and was still at the casino because he thought he would get it back by gambling more. This is very sad. You know, I should say that it sounds like a small percentage of people. It's only 1.5% who are what's called problem gamblers. Now, there's a distinction. I should say there's a distinction between problem gamblers and compulsive gamblers. The distinction is this, according to the, you know, this like psychoanalytic associations that make these definitions. The distinction is that a problem gambler is somebody who, well, let me say, a compulsive gambler is somebody who just loses control, does not have any control over reason, and therefore has to gamble, keeps gambling and gambling and without any control. But the problem gambler can affect life around him. That is, a family, friends. They start to borrow money from people. They steal to continue their gambling habits. Now, the compulsive gambling is about 5.4% of the American population.
Okay.
That's compulsive gamblers. Now, that's a large percentage.
So those are people who can't control themselves, but they're not necessarily hurting other people.
That's right. And they may even have the money to do it. You know, as I may, this is people who just have to be, you know, at the casino or online or whatever, and that's, you know, they're not affecting anybody else. But after a while, they start to affect other people. Mm. But it's a much smaller percentage. It's only 1.4 or 1.5% of the public that are problem gamblers. Now, that's a large number of people.
It's a
very large number of people.
Yeah.
So, and then the famous gamblers, as you point out, these are well known. I mean, you know that I talk about in the book. I break down the whole novel of Dostoevsky, which is there are also the letters from his wife that are in the book that talk about his gambling addictions.
You mentioned a minute ago somebody that you met in the casino while you were researching. How much time did you spend in the casinos?
Well, I spent a lot of time in European casinos, and I spent more time in European casinos than American casinos. For example, I was in Monte Carlo and Nice and some gambling places in England. England has a betting shop on almost every street corner.
Okay.
Every little town, there's always a betting shop. And these are private concerns. It's not like here where, you know, it's off-track betting. But this is private concerns. So I spent a lot of time talking to people, to professional gamblers, and observing people in European casinos.
Did you gamble a lot?
No. I didn't, because that wasn't the issue. I can't reveal the name of the person who also wrote a book on gambling, but he got a very large advance for his book, and to do his research, he went out to the casinos and spent the entire advance for his book on his observations and his research.
Oh, dear.
In other words, he lost it all.
Yeah. Well, I have a question for you. My son is 19, and he's going to be on vacation soon in a place where he will legally be allowed to gamble. So do you have advice that I can give to him about wanting to try gambling for the fun of it, but wanting to do so in a controlled and reasonable manner?
Read my book.
There you go.
There we go. Yeah, that's a good question. There are certain effects that he should be aware of. And if he could be consciously aware of these effects, which they're all spelled out in the book, but I'll give a list of them. There's the break-even effect, you know. The break-even effect, there's the chasing losses effect, there's the house money effect, there's the early win effect, there's the fame effect, and then there's the churn-as-due effect, which we talked about a little bit.
Right.
The fame effect is, people are watching you. And you're going to do things that are not quite rational simply because people are watching you. I talk about this with the background of the TV game Deal or No Deal, you know, where people can be rational when they're at home, and then they get into the studio and they have 3 million people watching them on TV, and they do things that they would never have done had they not been in front of 3 million people.
That poor woman who turned down the one suitcase and got a penny in the other.
That's right. You know, she could have had $100,000, and instead she got a penny.
Right.
But there's also the what's called, and this is what I just read in the introduction, the early win effect. That is, because you had an early win, and I've seen this many times in the casino, novices coming in, they've never played blackjack before, and they sit at the blackjack table, and they, I'm going to use that word, lucky, they lucky, and an early win, and that means that they are going to continue. Well, okay, that early win means that whatever they've won is now what's called house money. It's not their money. They didn't get it by working. They got it by, you know, as a gift, really. That's the way they think of it.
Sure.
They don't have a W-2 for it. You know, it's not something that really they had to earn. So that money, that house money effect takes on a psyche of its own where they feel that they can spend it and it's easily spent. So they bet that. But pretty soon that's going to come up with a point where they're going to start to lose.
Yeah.
Right? And when they start to lose, then the next effect is the break-even effect. And I said, well, you know, let me gamble a little bit more so that I break even.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so they're trying to break even. But that doesn't happen so easily.
And it might take a really long time.
Almost break even, and then they lose again, perhaps. And then they start... And then what kicks in is the chasing losses effect. They start to chase the loss that they had. And they keep chasing that loss, and then they're in trouble.
Yeah.
So pretty soon they're in trouble. Yeah. So that's the scheme that I would be watching out for. And I would tell your son, watch out for that, because if he could be conscious of that, then he'd have some control over it, or he might have control over it.
Right. Okay, I have one last question for you, Joe, and that is, as a writer, and perhaps understanding something about the challenges that writers face today, can you speak a little bit to the odds of getting something published, if it's a good piece of writing, to the odds of getting published?
You know, I really can't speak to that, because I have to say that I've never been in that situation.
Oh, wow.
It's a funny thing. Well, let me tell you how my first book got published.
Okay. That'll
give some indication. I was working on this book, and I had, I probably had finished maybe half of it or so, something like that. And I thought, well, it's time to show it to somebody. So I called a friend who had an agent, and I said, what's your agent's name? And he gave me the agent, and I sent this off to the agent. The agent was very nice. Sent me a rejection letter, and he said, you know, I love your writing. I really love it. I think it's terrific, beautiful writing. But, and I saw the but, and I knew it's the end. He said, I don't know how to pitch this book.
Right.
And he said, but let me give you the name of another agent. But don't tell that other agent I sent you, because that's the kiss of death.
Hmm.
When one agent sends... an author to another agent.
It means they didn't want it.
It means they didn't want it, of course. So I sent it to the second agent, and it was exactly the same thing. He said, I love your writing, but I just don't know how to pitch it.
Hmm.
So, and this was over, I don't know, maybe a 2 or 3 week period. And then I decided, well, I would sent it to an editor at an imprint from Pearson. It's a bigger publisher, but they had a small press called Pie Press.
Okay.
And I sent it by email to this editor on a Friday, and Monday morning he called me up and he said, let's do it.
Wow.
And from then on, you know, it was easy for me. I mean, in fact, publishers call me. I don't call publishers to write books.
How many books have you written?
Four at this point. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, that's a very that's a lucky story.
I mean, so I don't know. I don't know why people don't get published easily. I mean, I don't want to be smug about that, because I know that it is difficult.
Yeah.
And maybe I should say it this way. I think that I was very lucky.
Hmm.
And perhaps, you know, because I was a finalist for the Penn Award too. And that was probably very lucky, too, because I know the following year I was a judge for the Penn Award, and I know how lucky it is because, you know, it's a question of really what book you really pick up and really fall in love with.
Right.
And that's so subjective. So I don't want to be discouraging for people because, you know, it just because something didn't get published does not mean it's not good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just there's so much out there. I heard figures of something like almost 200,000 books published a year now.
Yeah. I think there are more and more books being published, and there are more venues for publishing, and yet it's getting harder because there are more and more people writing.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, listen, Joe, I really appreciate your taking time to talk to me today.
Well, it was my pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Joe Mazur. His full name, in fact, is Joseph Conrad Mazur. This is a great writer's story, and it's on his Amazon page. Joe Mazur's mother bought a used copy of Lord Jim in London on her way from Vienna to America, thinking that if she could read it with a dictionary, it might improve her English. Mazur's mother was Polish-born, as was Joseph Conrad, and so she felt that English written by a Pole must be easy to understand. This week's Write the Book prompt was suggested by my guest, Joseph Mazur, and I'm going to include it in his words as he sent the prompt to me in an email. So this is a quote from Joseph Mazur. "You know that nonfiction writing requires the writer to bring readers to places they haven't ever been and to tell them things they have not known. In one single sentence, that is the task of the nonfiction writer. But to keep readers reading, a book must be alive with human experience, and that's the job of anecdotal entrances and anecdotal relief. Anecdotes are there to first amuse and therefore hook the reader, and then to give clues to what the book is about. If you are writing nonfiction, try weaving into it as much anecdotal material as possible. Take a look at some of Stephen Jay Gould's books for fine examples. Gould was the king of anecdotal entrances. There are a few principles to favor when using a leading anecdote. Bring in something that the reader can identify with, a character, a place, an object, or a brief amusement. Watch out for making it too specific. Specificity has an uncanny way of creeping into the lead to defeat the hook." And Joseph Mazur writes, "I introduce each of my own books with lead anecdotes." This is from a book that he wrote about truth and logic in mathematics. "I came to understand mathematics by way of a Russian novel." And then the first sentence of a book about time and motion was, "My father was the first person to tell me about paradoxes of time." The first sentence in a book about the history and psychology of gambling, which is going to sound familiar to you, "When I was a child, my uncles would gather every Saturday at my grandparents' house to sit at a long dining table, telling jokes while accounting their week's gambling wins and losses." And finally, this is the first sentence in a book by Joseph Mazur about learning math in an inner city high school. "My own high school days were the near misfortune of my teenage years." He continues, "What about anecdotal relief? In most cases, relief suggests a reprieve from something burdensome. And burdensome reading is never a welcome task. However, unless it is memoir or biography, nonfiction often involves the burden of strings of complicated information that tend to swell into what sometimes seems to be disconnected from thoughts of the real world. And even the best nonfiction writers need to think about anecdotal relief, just as the most indefatigable readers need respite." That, again, was sent to me by Joseph Mazur in an email, and I will include the text of his email on the podcast site this week. Good luck with this prompt, and please listen next week for another. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. And you can check out upcoming shows by looking at my blog, writethebook.wordpress.com. And finally, a reminder, if you have comments about the show or news about book-related events, do send an email. The address is writethebook@gmail.com. Please remember that this station is here thanks to community support and involvement. More information about The Radiator is available online at theradiator.org. Stay tuned. Cheryl Willoughby will be here any minute to bring you the world of music, and that starts at 3 o'clock. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont.